We all know that women are not funny. And no one proves it better than Kay Ballard, the accidental lawyer who is the accidental host of our show. Of course, every accident that Kay Ballard encounters is intentional. And now her intention is to accidentally disprove the show's premise. So sit back and enjoy a fun conversation that matters between Kay and today's fabulous featured guest. Welcome to Women Are Not Funny Radio.
Hello, this is Kay Ballard, and I'm so glad that you're back from your holiday. My inbox was flooded with emails from grateful listeners thanking me for giving them a week off. And through that very act, you told me that you love this show like there is no tomorrow. Let's just ponder on that for a moment. But whether or not there is a tomorrow, there's definitely a today, and we're right in the middle of it. And today, our guest is the fabulous Kathleen Ritterizer, an investment specialist and stand-up comedian and speaker. And we are talking about a stand-up comedian with an MBA from NYU. She's also an author of two books, Foundation and Endowment Investing, Strategies of Top Investors and Institutions, and then the newest book released sometime, I believe, in the late spring or early summer, Top Hedge Fund Investors, Stories, Strategies, and, my goodness, I can't read the last word, and advice. Well, Kathleen comes to us today from New York City, and here's what we're going to be talking about. I think we all want to know these days, is it a good idea to be investing when actually most of us have a mattress where we could store our money? And what's so funny about the world of foundations? And what the heck are foundations, and what are hedge funds for that matter? And we also want to know about her experience as a stand-up comic and her experience as a speaker and how they might be related. And finally, I must have her opinion. I want to know who had the greatest Great American Depression, our great-grandmothers or us? It's a competition, I believe. But before we can get into any of that, you know what I must ask her. And certainly it's not because I'm paranoid, because goodness knows I have very good self-esteem and a good self-opinion. But I have to know, Kathleen, are you here as a stepping stone here at Women Are Not Funny, as a stepping stone for something better?
Hi, Kay. Well, thank you for having me. And as a matter of fact, this call is a stepping stone to something somewhat better, which are cocktails after work.
Well, you know what? I'm not offended by that comment, particularly since I have something else important to ask. I couldn't help but notice, looking at your LinkedIn profile,
uh-huh.
that you have a history in radio.
Yes.
In fact, you have, I was blown away by the fact that you were, as an undergraduate, general manager of the campus radio station at Franklin and Marshall.
That's
could
correct.
Could you by any chance be here to take over my show?
Well,
do you have designs on my show?
I have to say that a year or so ago, probably longer, I wrote a piece on this, which is that when I was a senior in college, a friend of mine said to me, well, what's it going to be? You're going to be a DJ? Is it DJ art or money? And I chose money. So don't you worry. I'm not coming after your radio show. I'm staying strictly in financial in hedge funds for now.
Well, your answer kind of gives me the idea that you have some sort of insight as to the financial situation of this radio show. But, you know, that wouldn't be unusual.
That's pretty typical for most radio shows, I think.
Well, you know what? My millions of listeners, I'm paid by the adoration of millions of listeners or some, you know, somewhat less. So, hedge funds. You know, I am fascinated by them, actually,
uh-huh.
and it mostly has to do with not understanding them at all.
Right, Right. And I think, you know, that is definitely one of the big issues with hedge funds, and there's reasons, there's very practical reasons for that. The SEC laws and regulations don't allow for the average investor to invest in hedge funds, and that is because some of the techniques that are used within hedge funds to manage portfolios are by themselves risky techniques and could potentially lose a lot of money. So the SEC has mandated that that only a certain type of qualified investor with a certain amount of net worth can really invest in hedge, is really allowed to invest in hedge funds. And it means that hedge funds, you have to, for me, I'm couching my language because you have to be careful what you say about them and how they're marketed. So it's a very practical reason. That's one. But because of the way hedge funds are, they're kind of mysterious and have historically been secretive, the media has tended to kind of focus in on those elements, the mysteriousness, the secretive, as well as kind of like when a hedge fund goes awry, because that's kind of exciting. I mean, Bernie Madoff having a big fraud is a lot more exciting than some average guy who keeps his head down and does his work and delivers very large returns over a long period of time. So what has happened is the natural need for the industry to be very quiet about what it does and how it does things, and the media's natural inclination to blow bad things out of proportion, have made hedge funds seem like a very scary thing to most investors. And when we wrote our book, we did a little bit. The book that Top Hedge Fund Investors is really for a professional hedge fund investor, but we do include in the front some overview of the industry and why this is the case. And we talk about the fact that a lot of investors are invested in hedge funds in one way or another, mainly through pension plans, so on and so forth, and that they really are actually a way for a sophisticated portfolio to get good returns and reduce the risk that their capital is taking. It's basically reducing the amount of risk that their portfolio is taking. Again, these are all for professional investors. So you needn't be scared of hedge funds. You need to know that for the most part, the average investor isn't really able to invest in them, and the majority of hedge funds are actually very good, solid investments that actually don't take as much risk as you would with the S&P 500. So I know that that's kind of a convoluted, long-winded way of answering the question, and maybe not quite getting at it. There is a lot of mystery in the industry, but once you look at it and just study it very closely, I didn't know anything about hedge funds when I started working at a hedge fund, and I taught myself what a hedge fund was by going on the internet. And once I spent a little time on it, I figured out that it really is actually a quite useful and effective way to be managing money.
I loved your story.
I loved your
explanation, and it was very clear to me. And particularly, you know, your explanation really of why we find them a little bit sexy is they are mysterious. Now, listeners to my show have long ago given up on it actually being funny. You know, I mean, we try to maintain a ratio of laughs per hour. You know, we're usually going for 3 chuckles per hour and 1 out and out smile.
Okay.
If we accomplish that, then, you know, we just celebrate. But so I want to, at the risk of bringing our ratio down a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about this because, in the first place, I'm very interested in it. In the second place, it gives me an opportunity to talk about me and my own experience.
Okay.
Kathleen, I think you know that I'm a lawyer, and I was a foundation executive for a period of years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a large national women's educational foundation, and we were, at that time, we had assets of about $150 million,
mm-hmm.
which some of it was in real estate, but I would say maybe 20% was in real estate. And so that's not a huge foundation. That's a big, mm-hmm. It's a nice size foundation, but it's not a Harvard, right? Or a Princeton or anything like that. But we did have endowed funds with a lot of different rules. And I, you know, first let me say that one of the things that I discovered in my period of time working for foundation and consulting to other foundations is there was research done about how what people think about foundations, and you're probably familiar with it. All people think is that they're probably something good. They really mm-hmm. don't know what they are, but they think
right.
they're something good, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you start there. People don't even know what a foundation is. But in my particular foundation, I just want to tell listeners how this is, how it worked. So there was a board of trustees, and they had another volunteer board, which were the advisors to the fund, is what they were known as.
Okay.
And then there was an investment consultant
yep.
who worked for the advisors to the fund
mm-hmm.
to advise them on the investing of the companies that were doing the vesting for us.
Right.
And so then, you know, there were so many layers to offer protection to essentially the board of trustees for decisions they might make. And, of course, they were covered by liability insurance as well. So
mm-hmm.
it was a huge, huge infrastructure just
yep.
to make sure that everyone got everything right. Right.
Right. Well, that's a pretty typical structure, although whether it's designed to get the investments right is up for question sometimes. A lot of times that structure is there to protect everybody from if they make the wrong decision, or it can lead to a very stultifying investment process. So
It totally is stultifying.
That is, I mean, that's one of the reasons we wrote the Foundation and Endowment book, was to show that there are there's a very famous investor in the inside baseball investor who runs the Yale portfolio named David Swensen, and he's written a book called Pioneering Portfolio Management. And a lot of investors in foundation endowment portfolio managers have kind of, in a very simple way, tried to copy the David Swensen approach, which most organizations are not, as you talked about, are not as big as Yale, which has about $16 billion. So we wrote our book to really kind of cover a lot of other different types of investors who've been successful investing these large, long-term portfolios. And I would say that there are a lot of suboptimal ways, which is, I mean, if you want a word that's going to give you a chuckle, I think suboptimal is a good one. But
I love it.
Whenever people say it's always suboptimal, like there was a period where I said that all the time because I just thought it was like so cool, like it's so like jargony. But basically, it is kind of a suboptimal way. But what we try to do is show that there really is good ways to run these portfolios if you have the right professionals in place, and that I do think you're right though that there is a lot of there's not actually much overlap between what a foundation is doing and then how the portfolios are being invested. And really what the investment process can do, if done correctly, is help the foundation do its work at a more effective pace and with more money. So that's really the idea of having a really good, solid investment process and learning from some experts in how to do it better. But at the same time, the approach that your organization took is actually fairly typical, but unfortunately it tends to lead to suboptimal investment decisions.
Well, absolutely, and having you describe it as stultifying is terribly accurate. Now, let me tell you this little story.
Uh-huh.
When I first started working for the foundation, I was my foundation was in Washington, D.C., and I lived out of the city in the mountains in a beautiful place I still own. And I was there on a Friday, just a day off, and I got a call that was transferred to me. And someone had, since I was in fundraising and the estate planning aspect of that, the call went to me, and it was from someone who had made a large contribution
mm-hmm.
in her will, and her banker and her lawyer were both on the phone, and they had been worried about it for a long time. They were very concerned. It was $800,000 tied up in one stock.
Oh, okay.
And so they definitely wanted us to take action. Well, Kathleen, I didn't know I wasn't authorized to do that sort of thing. So I actually called one of our advisors, and I can't remember the guy's name, but he's someone who used to be on Lou Rukeyser all the time.
Uh-huh.
Really top guy. And for some reason, he was able to take my call. And I said, okay, we're talking about Bausch & Lomb. He said, you know, as it happens, I researched it last week. He goes, sell. I said, still, they sold. And then, of course, I found out the following week that I really wasn't supposed to operate that way.
Well, hopefully it was a good sale, so they looked the other way.
I was certainly the darling, but they realized that they had a darling who was something of a cowboy. But I just, you know, it was before I had really understood that we were supposed to do stultifying. Okay. It was before I studied that. But here's the other story I want to tell you, and then I will let you talk. So I had the experience, my executive director of the association that the foundation was attached to had a big kind of quasi-social event. She lived in New York City and commuted to D.C. and was very well connected in social and financial circles in Manhattan, and had a big event that I attended. And there was a woman who was a friend of hers who just started working for a company, and she was on the sales side of hedge funds. And strangely enough, even though she was a social friend of my boss, she determined that the way to get to my boss was through me. So she arranged to come into D.C. and take both of us to lunch and tell us about hedge funds. Well, Kathleen, it was the funniest thing in the world. Here we were, three ostensibly smart women. None of us knew anything about hedge funds, trying to have a conversation about hedge funds. The woman working for the hedge fund company that didn't know anything about it. And, you know, it was just a really, really strange occasion. At that time, the advice we were getting is, oh, my goodness, stay away. But my perception is that has changed completely, that foundations and their portfolio managers are extremely open to hedge funds at this time.
Oh, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, that's really kind of how I got into knowing about foundations and endowments, was because I was working for a hedge fund, and foundation and endowments were early institutional investors in hedge funds. And in a number of the people that we wrote about in the book, Foundation and Endowment Investing, both books are profiles of individual investors. So there are individual stories about people who have been successful and how they go about investing their portfolios and how they make decisions, et cetera. And many of them were very early to investing in hedge funds. So yes, hedge funds have been in foundation, especially the larger foundations and endowments like Stanford and Yale, have been in their portfolio since the early 1990s. But many pensions and other kind of large institutional investors still are kind of nibbling around the corners, or not really are kind of a little concerned about what we call headline risk, meaning that they don't want their institution to be written up in the paper because they were invested in Bernie Madoff, let's say. So, but yes, you're absolutely right. It's definitely an asset class that institutional investors in foundations and endowments in particular have been very much more comfortable with, and have been some of the foundations and endowments that have bigger portfolios and have better investment performance. A big reason for that better investment performance has been because of their early and large commitment to investing in hedge funds.
Well, see, this is where the rubber really hits the road, and this is the thing that I think is so interesting, is how these two worlds collide.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, as an executive level fundraiser, I was working with people who were very, very well healed. Okay, and many of them were somewhat sophisticated in financial matters, but a lot of them weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the woman that I mentioned who made a gift of $800,000 of Bausch & Lomb stock, I mean, she had owned it since she was a young woman. Her dad had given it to her, I suppose. And then, you know, she it's strange how these things happen. She did not remain a young woman.
Uh-huh.
You know, years went by, and eventually she was an elderly woman. But all during that time, she was a school librarian.
Uh-huh.
A school librarian who had $800,000 worth of stock that she did not spend on herself. And from what I know, she led a very modest life.
Huh.
And wanted that as a gift to the foundation to provide educational opportunities.
Wow.
For women who were seeking, because my foundation supported people who were doing doctoral training, essentially.
Okay.
Other things too. But anyway, you know, the point is there's such an obligation when you are investing money that has come to you that way, has come to you anyway, I suppose. But, you know, the people many times who are giving their money, which is hard-earned or hard-saved or just they have by happenstance, however they come about it,
mm-hmm.
they believe when they give it to a foundation, and particularly if they put it in an endowed fund, that it is never going to go away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's right.
So that's the burden.
Right, yes.
You know, that is the burden, is being true to that belief, even if that belief is perhaps, in some respects, naive.
Right. No, that is actually one of the main tenets of investing foundation and endowment portfolios, is this idea that that you want to preserve the principal or the capital in perpetuity. So that you're trying to manage these portfolios to outpace inflation, but also make enough money to be able to support the activities. And that's a big issue in college. But that's absolutely right, that woman held on to that aid. She was probably earning interest and dividends or whatever on that portfolio. Her father probably told her to never sell it.
Exactly.
And that when she gave it, that she – the expectation is that – the 800,000 will live on forever. And the reality is that is something that endowments and foundations do try to do. So they try, the main goal is to really preserve that 800,000, and whether it's been sold, the way you talked about, let's sell it and get the 800,000, or whether it's held on to. But the idea is to make sure that you preserve that capital, but to also be able to sustain the institution and into perpetuity, which is a lot of what foundations and particularly what endowments can do. So it's interesting because it's interesting how you're talking about was this woman who really, I'm guessing, you know, it really is, I don't know if this is certainly the time to talk about it, but it's almost like women are not funny and they're not good with their finances. Women are not financial, and you know, certainly that's often a topic that comes up is how women are approaching finances versus it probably was it sounds like her portfolio was pretty conservative and she had a conservative approach to how she managed those assets, where I think other people may have just gone ahead and sold the you know, if she didn't have other assets, someone else might have told her to, or I certainly would have, to have sold those assets a long time ago and then diversified the portfolio.
Oh, of course.
And so hopefully she had other ones too on top,
That's just the point. They were very concerned because there was no diversity. They've been concerned about it for years. So it wasn't, in that respect, a conservative portfolio, right?
No,
it was really on the edge.
That's a very risky, that's actually a very risky approach. And it does, I mean, this is probably not a good, because risk is an area that I'm more of a, in the hedge fund industry, I'm not an investment professional, I'm a marketing professional. So my job is really to develop relationships and have people come in and to be able to kind of explain to them the basics of what our organization does or the other organizations I work for. And risk is kind of a complex thing, and there's a lot of counterintuitive thinking around risk, but that's one that someone could easily convince themselves that having all of their money in one particular asset that is perceived to be a safe asset is a good idea. And guess what? That leads you to making an investment in a Madoff-like situation. So there's a lot of similarity, but you're absolutely right. That's actually much riskier behavior than if you had your assets in a bunch of hedge funds or even in just a bunch of a number of other stocks in addition to Bausch & Lomb, which I know nothing about or what its status is today. So
Yeah, I'm not even sure the company's still in business, but at the, you know, at the time, I think the reason I got that phone call in the middle of the afternoon is her lawyer and banker were aware of it and had been concerned about it for a very long time.
Yes,
so
yes.
The moment found itself. but at any rate, you know, it's interesting. So when you left your career, your very promising career in radio, and went into it looks like to me that one of your early stops, career stops, was at Merrill Lynch.
Yes.
Dearly departed, right?
Well, it's for now.
You know,
I'd say for now.
I tell you what, it's just kind of interesting to me because, and you as a speaker are going to understand this, but when I was actively speaking, which I hope to at some point again, but when I was actively speaking, many times Merrill Lynch would pay my speaker's fee for the, you know, for whatever the organization had hired me. And so I was quite fond of Merrill Lynch.
Uh-huh.
So your book, I assume your book has been driving a lot of speaking engagements. Is that the case?
That is definitely the case. I've spoken at mostly industry conferences, both conferences focused on foundation and endowment, chief investment officers and interested parties, as well as hedge fund industry conferences. So that's kind of sort of where the rubber meets the road. It's all, most foundations and endowments have been investing in alternative style investments, which hedge funds fall under that broad category of alternative investments, along with private equity, venture capital, real estate, things like that. And my, as I said earlier, my kind of entree into knowing foundations and endowments was because I was working for a hedge fund. So that's kind of the genesis of – that's sort of like the trajectory of my career, as well as like kind of the genesis of the two books are the knowing the foundation and endowment market and then also knowing the hedge fund market. So that's kind of where I do most of my speaking is in those categories.
Well, my guess is that once someone hears you speak, they're so excited about having an engaging speaker in those fields that I'm sure you are hired a lot for that. I will confess to listeners and to you, Kathleen, you have my apologies. I have not read your book.
Uh-huh.
My Kindle took a look at it and decided it was a little rich for its blood. You know,
Somebody told me it's I guess it's the same price on Kindle. I don't have a Kindle yet, or I don't even have an iPad. I'm so behind the times on that regard. But somebody told me that it actually costs the same on Kindle, or like only $5 less or something like that than it would cost as like a regular book. So, you know, I totally understand. I mean, it is priced like a. It's priced as a professional book. I mean, it's really kind of priced. Well, I mean, we fought this, trust me, but it's priced.
Yeah, but I think it's the kind of book that it's going to belong in the libraries of a lot of institutions.
Exactly.
And your publisher is Wiley, and they know how to price it, and they know how they can,
exactly.
You know, it's not popularly priced. Let's say that. But one of the things that I noticed in the in one of the reviews is. There were comments about how engaging your writing is, and I can certainly believe that. And I know you are an engaging speaker. So that's the question for you now. How do you combine this well-developed sense of humor and the ability to make people laugh that you have nurtured over the years? How do you combine that with your work as an author and as a speaker in these very well, what should we say? We've already determined they're not dry. It's an interesting field, but in this very specific, specialized field.
Right, kind of the corporate, you know, how do you – it's a challenge. It's really a challenge, I think. that was always when I'm sure the audience is well aware of your presence on Twitter as mine, and that's how we first quote unquote met. And basically that's something I've been dealing with for a few years now, and that I honestly can be a struggle at times. And it's the Wall Street by day, comedy legend by night idea, is that you almost do have to compartmentalize it in some ways. What I try to do is I'm just at a point in my life where I think the way I've been able to do it, and I'm still kind of muddling through it in some ways, is that I have, because of the books, they've developed my credibility in the industry. So I'm speaking as a credible, knowledgeable person about what institutional investors think and how they approach their portfolios and how they approach investing. So I have knowledge and I have relationships with people that I've spoken to and that I've met because I've written these books. And so that gives me, it doesn't just give me the credibility, but it does kind of tweak my positioning into a creative bucket that not everybody who has my job, my full-time job in the industry, is in. So as a writer, as someone who's written, that gives me some kind of a creative aura that mm-hmm. I think gives me a little bit of ability to kind of then expand and be humorous in my conversations and things like that. So I think I've been trying to really just play off of that. For the most part, when I'm speaking at conferences, what I do try to do, and I've even done this in the book, and I can talk about a couple of things that I've done that are kind of, I find them amusing anyway, is that I always try to say something that's funny or make some kind of, try to find some funny ways to say things that are serious. So a good example is earlier this year, after my book came out, I was invited to speak at a conference, and I literally had, the book was literally just on the shelves, and I'm speaking at this event, and that morning in the shower, I was trying to think about how to organize my opening remarks and talk about the lessons from the book. And one thing that is a phrase that we all talk about is coming out of the financial crisis is, oh, you know, too big to fail. So what I said was that one of the lessons of the crisis for hedge funds was that hedge funds themselves as an industry were still a relatively small part of the overall asset management business and had gotten a lot of blame for things during the financial crisis that was unwarranted. You know, everybody's pointing fingers, oh, hedge funds are bad, when in fact hedge funds had done what they were supposed to do in people's portfolios, not as well as they're supposed to, but they did it, and they bounced back relatively quickly. So the majority of the industry actually earned back everything that it had lost in 2008 and 2009. But what I did say was that one of the lessons is that these organizations are almost, they're a little bit like garage bands, a lot of the hedge fund companies. They're small, a lot guys that came out of a trading desk, that came out of another hedge fund. So it's a very kind of, it is, it's like kind of a bit of a sophisticated garage band industry. And I said that, instead of talking about it that way, which I think is kind of amusing, but is basically that hedge funds aren't too big to fail. That's not true, but hedge funds are too big to flail. So I tried mm-hmm. to come up with something that is a little bit amusing and catchy and has a way of showing my humor. Another thing that I did was when I was writing the first book, we were doing some historical analysis of how foundations and endowments got to be such sophisticated investors, and there was a lot of laws that changed in 1969, and this was as a result of the work of the Ford Foundation. So basically the Ford Foundation decided, you know what, we have a lot of money and we're giving a lot of money to educational institutions, and they have their own money. So let's figure out how to help them manage their money better so we can give our money to other people, which is eventually what happened. But they helped pass kind of two sets of regulations, both in 1969, that changed how foundations and endowments approach investing and allowed them to start to really grow and build these portfolios and to be able to make more sophisticated investment decisions. And what I did was I wrote about in summary, I said, many things happened in 1969. Now, remember, this is in a professional book that's priced, as we know, at like $60, et cetera, and it's for professionals. And I wrote, 1969 was a seminal year in foundations and endowments, and it was all, you know, it was the year of Woodstock, of man landing on the moon, and the Mets winning the World Series. So I basically tried to bury some, like, funny pop culture reference in the text, you know, as a way of somebody, you know, somebody being able to come along and have a little smile. And in that same sentence, one of the guys that did some of this legal work to help change these rules, it was actually investment work, was a professor named Robert Barker. So I put in parentheses, not the beloved host of The Price is Right, but a professor from Smith College. So I try to build it into and make it part of my personality. So like, if this had been, you know, 25 years ago, me coming out of school and kind of getting into the workplace, I mean, I never could have imagined that I would have. I tried even then to be funny, and I was just a wacko. Now because I've kind of backed into being this creative person who also knows a lot about the industry and knows a lot of people, it's a lot easier to get away with. But to be as funny as I want to be and as I have been when I wasn't working full time in the industry, it's a lot harder now because you know people are somewhat paranoid about who they're doing business with as a result of the financial crisis and as a result of the Madoff fraud. So I have to be careful. And so that's one of the reasons I don't really perform as much as I was for a period of time, and I have made some of my outward communication, especially what I've been doing on Twitter, it's one of the reasons I privatized it, and that had a lot to do with I was going to be speaking at an event, and I almost got fired from this speaking engagement because somebody in the department at this bank that had hired me to do a speaking engagement had taken it, you know, some random person had taken it upon themselves to Google me and found my 12 hoes of Tiger Woods blog post, which was basically I took the 12 days of Christmas and turned it into a song about Tiger Woods, and it was kind of risque. And I've been at a point where when I wrote the books where I knew I wanted to get back into working in the industry, and I had to make a choice and say, well, in this particular instance, I'm going to sacrifice my creative freedom and being funny for, you know, my own personal greater good. And that goes back to the story that I told you at the beginning. It was this idea of really a better way of talking about it is this joke that I heard when I was a little kid and I could never sleep. And I was listening to my dad, I would stay up and my dad was watching Johnny Carson. I think it was probably David Steinberg came on and told Johnny Carson this joke, which was, you know, God came to King Solomon and said to him, what would you rather be? Would you rather be really wise, or would you rather have a lot of money? And, you know, King Solomon thought and thought and thought about it, and when it was over, he went to God and he said, you know, I'll take wisdom. And God said, okay, and gave him wisdom, and as soon as he got the wisdom, he knew he should have taken the money. So for me, it's been a little bit more of late of probably, you know, taking my creative side and really being comedy legend, comedy persona at night in a private way. I mean, if people want to follow me, I'll approve they were following me and things like that. But I think the industry is being careful and you have to be prudent. So I've decided to go a little bit more onto the prudent and private side, because I couldn't make a career at this point in my career of being a comedic person. So it was a choice I had to make, is that I feel like for me, being a very funny person who can make people laugh and get joy myself out of being able to do that in my free time, as well as being able to incorporate some of my humor and things that are appropriate into what I do, with the element of being known as kind of already kind of setting the stage as, oh, well, she's kind of creative because she's written these books. I think for now that's the best way for me to work it.
Well, you know what? I love that answer, and that is a great answer. You have a very honest answer.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things that I've experienced, Kathleen, is when I've raised this issue, particularly about my own work,
mm-hmm.
you know, people discount it, discount the concern.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an issue when you have both aspects of your personality that kind of whacked offside, and also one that's very serious, very knowledgeable,
right.
a good education, that, you know, all of that.
Right.
And so, and I think a lot of it, you know, we talk and write and read to the point of it just becoming boring about the whole issue of authenticity in social media.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some aspects of that because, you know, once again, you need to be authentic. You also need to be effective. And
mm-hmm.
that's really what you're talking about here is how can I still be my funny self,
right.
but maintain effectiveness and also make a living.
Right, exactly.
And
exactly.
It's really hard, but unless people have experienced it in, you know, in kind of the way you have and the kind of the way I have, they really don't understand. I don't think they're discounting it to be unkind or anything like that, but they just haven't experienced it in the same sort of way.
Right. I mean, that was, I remember telling some people the story about getting this panicky email and phone call from a woman who I'm friendly with, who had been the person who had gotten me this speaking engagement, and it's like, oh, somebody in the compliance department had a fit and freaking out and blah blah blah, and I was like, you know, all right, well, I'm not making, you know, I'm not Kathy Griffin, you know, I'm not. It's like when I used to run, I don't run anymore because I would get injured all the time, and finally, what stopped me was I was getting injured so much, and I was like, you know what, I'm not Greta Waits, you know, I'm not Greta. Weights. I'm not running so that I can, you know, make a living. I'm running because I want to get exercise. So I don't want to. I can find another exercise. So it was kind of this similar thing. If I was Kathy Griffin, I'd be like, no, I'm an artist. But you know, it was more for my own enjoyment, and it was something I would like to try to do in some. You know, I haven't taken down all of my funny stuff. I haven't stopped trying to say funny stuff on Twitter and things like that. It's just that the reality there is a lot of pressure. There is a lot of pressure to conform. Some of it kind of dumb, but in this industry in particular, there's a lot of very creative and smart. The thing I like about being in hedge funds as opposed to another part of the financial industry is that there is a little bit more room to be kind of a persona in this industry. So it from all my experience in financial services, I mean, I bounced around a lot of different jobs. I mean, you mentioned my LinkedIn profile earlier, and there's basically a section that's like lots of jobs. I forget what I call it. I think the title is various financial services jobs, and it goes for like a 5-year period where it was like I just hopped around and did a lot of different stuff because I couldn't really find the right place. So I think to the extent that I'm going to be in this business, hedge funds are a great place because it is young, it is creative, it is entrepreneurial. There's more room to be a character, but at the same time, you're dealing with institutional investors. It helped me to have written these books and have gotten to know these people as a journalist so that and I really know them more than the average salesperson who's calling on somebody. I've dealt with them as more of an equal. So that gives me a little bit of a pass as well.
Well, absolutely. And you know, another one of the things that you brought forward that you kind of mentioned in passing was the idea that there might be a period of paying your dues, establishing a certain level of credibility
mm-hmm.
before you step out and take some chances. But it's something, you know, I don't think we'll solve the issue today or really come up with anything that is going to be groundbreaking, although, you know, it could still happen.
But
one of the things
I have faith.
One of the things that I had hoped for originally with the Women Are Not Funny thing is to explore the whole issue of how women use humor as a leadership tool, if in fact they do and if it's possible. And one of the things that is problematic for women who are trying to do that, once again, is you also have to be taken seriously.
Right.
If you can use your humor to help you make to help you be taken seriously, that is what you're trying for, and that is a tricky sort of thing. And I can tell you this, one of my good friends who is just retired and was for a number of years the executive director of the of a women's leadership center at Rutgers University tells me there's just not been any study of this at all. You know, women using humor as a leadership tool. And I think I'm certain of this, not only from what you've said today, but just from what I know about you, that in your work, your humor does set you apart. And you are you are known for it, and that it is mostly a positive thing. But let's, you know, we've just talked on for a while. Let's get to some social media. Yes, I noticed that you made your accounts private, and I do remember the Tiger Woods series. It was hilarious. One of the things listeners should know is that Kathleen uses Twitter in a very creative way and kind of a tool for just various little comedy pieces, if you will. And she's a very low-maintenance Twitter friend because she doesn't tweet a lot. You don't tweet a lot. You, but what you put out is so funny, and I think one of our early conversations, and we've known each other there for well over 2 years, but one of our early conversations was about maybe some copyright concerns, because so much of your stuff is good, and certainly when it was out there, I can just imagine people stealing it.
Yes, I remember that. Thank you.
but you know, the things we put out there are so funny, and everyone who follows you loves you. And one of the things that you do with our mutual Twitter friend, New Media Jim, who is a very highly placed cameraman for NBC News. You and Jim have this hilarious thing going where you are corporate giving him instructions, and I love that. That's got to be one of the most that's just a classic Twitter stream, and it's got to be one of the most popular ones.
Well, that is so funny. That is such a, I mean, that is such a Twitter historical thing, because I discovered Twitter in a very weird way, which was I discovered it because I'm obsessed, as you might remember, I'm obsessed with the getting things done organization methodology. And I was reading all these blogs about getting organized, and getting organized and being more productive, and that led me to Twitter, of all things, which is, you know, to me the antithesis of productivity. And what happened was I got on Twitter relatively early, and I started, I mean, I could go on about, you know, how I started using it and how I developed a following there, which, I mean, no one is more surprised than me probably about me having the following that I have, just because it was like this, oh, what's this? Oh, okay, well, here, let's do this, let's do that. And I did a combination of sucking up to the big kids and kind of approaching it like you would being a new kid in, like, the sixth grade homeroom. Like, all right, who do I need to know? Who do I need to stay away from? Whose coattails can I ride on? But I just started having conversations with people. And what had happened was, is that Jim had been the massacre at Virginia Tech happened shortly after I had started on Twitter, and New Media Jim was assigned to be the cameraman who went down there for NBC, and he was tweeting about it, and he eventually posted how he had written a blog post about his experience there and how it was driving viewers to NBC News. and from tweeting about it. And he said, oh, and he tweeted something along the lines of, oh, should I send it to the superiors at NBC? And that was it. I basically, that was the beginning of Corporate Says. And it was like I said something like, Corporate Says, we like your moxie. Yeah, definitely put it up there, you know, and that was the beginning. It was just like, and it's funny because it does play off that whole conversation, which is now going on 3.5 years of Corporate Says, Jim, you should do this. Corporate Says, you should do that. It stems very much from my own experience and the lack of humor and the stupid things that happen in corporate America. And it's a way for me to comment, I think, comedically on corporate style thinking, which has always been one of the things that I think if I were to do stand up more, and some of the stand up that I've done is around being in these stupid corporate environments and some things that go on that are just dumb or that are just, let's just leave it at dumb. And basically that's how Jim said to me one time when I met him, he was like, what's so funny is like, you're always so right about like,
exactly.
You know, the kind of thinking and like the sort of like, oh, you were sick. Well, you know, we're not going to pay you extra and you know, oh, thanks for suffering through that, you know, travel. We'll get you an extra soda in the cafeteria next week. I mean, some of the things that I've done that are kind of like some standards within that are to me like just the extreme of what actually really does happen in a corporate environment. And I can still remember one of the funniest things was that I thought was when I gave him this job title, which was like EVP of cross media platform integration, because it's such a stupid job title. Yet you probably know somebody that actually really does. Somebody, I'm sorry if I'm offending a listener who actually has that job title, but it's kind of like this goofy made up corporate job title. So it's things like that where I really am trying to make a comment on corporate life in a way that is it's a roundabout way, but I think it can be really effective.
Yeah, well, it is, and probably what you did with that is not offend someone but inspire someone. They probably have given that title. They're in the process right now. They're writing a memo to HR to.
Yeah, we think we'll call it cross-media platform integration. I mean, I actually, that's the other thing. Go on my LinkedIn profile. When I wasn't working, I actually put up, I forgot that LinkedIn always, like, sends out emails and updates. Like, if you change a comma in your LinkedIn profile, it'll send an email to your friends like, oh, Kathleen changed her profile. And so I created this job, this company called DFE Industries, and I made my title cross-media platform integration, the EVP of cross-media platform integration, because I didn't have a company or a job or anything, and so I just named it that, and then I never changed it because I was like, oh, it's a, like, it was, people would be like, oh, saw you had a new job, and I'd be like, it's a joke, and they'd be like, well, what is it? And I'd say, DFE, that stands for disgruntled former employee. And I had this baked up, but I was too embarrassed. Like, I was like, I can't take it down now, like, because everybody, then they'll be like, oh, what happened?
So that is so funny.
Left it up there.
So what, you know, I hate Facebook's Greasy Green Guts, and Women Are Not Funny does have an official presence there, but we actually have just a wonderful production assistant who helps us out there. But what are you doing on Facebook?
Oh, my God. Oh, it's really interesting. I know, you know what? I kind of hate Facebook, but I use Facebook more like differently than I use Twitter, although there is more convergence than there used to be. But it's a completely different audience for me. It's a completely audience. It's a completely different set of people. And there's many more. There's family. I have my family members are on Facebook. I have a lot of my initial Facebook friends were people that were Twitter friends, et cetera. So there's crossover, but there's so many other different people that I don't, that would never be on Twitter that I can communicate with on Facebook. So I try to use it I've ended up using it in a similar way, but it's interesting because there's a group of people on Facebook that really aren't on everything else. So for them, I mean, in a way, Facebook is kind of like better for me than Twitter these days, because Twitter has just gotten so loud and crowded, and that the conversation is really, remember you and I had that conversation with Carrie Bugbee a few months ago that was like at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was a little bit like, oh, this is the old Twitter, this is how it used to be. Whereas Facebook, I'm finding there's more conversation, but it's with people I know who really don't get what would be on Twitter from anybody else. So they're kind of get, so I'm like the funniest person in the world to them. And that's nice. So like I'm always getting, you are the funniest person I follow. The things you do on Facebook are so funny, and it's coming from people that really aren't, they're never going to be on Twitter. So it's a nice, it's kind of a nice way to balance, and I probably communicate, and I what I do like about Facebook more and more is that it is engendering more conversation with the comments, so that you actually can have a few more people that are talking about something. And I also try to make use of, they don't have it anymore, but I used to really try to make, when their status update was Kathleen Ritterizer is, and the is was built in, I used to really have fun with the is. Now they've taken that away, so it's I don't use it as much anymore. But I used to enjoy, you know, saying is and filling it in with something like completely ridiculous. And I would do a lot of, so I will do different things here for the most part. And I like it for that. I mean, I've written and I've commented mostly, and I'm not aggressive enough to like start a movement, but the Facebook party, you know, anti-privacy movement or something like that. It concerns me, the bait and switch, you know, at a very simple level, the bait and switch of what they've done, what they've promised people in terms of their privacy and what they're really delivering. But for the most part, you know, for what I like to use it for, which is fun stuff, it's fine, and I do find that it's enough of a different group of people and audience that I can do different things with it. And a great example, and I didn't even do this to be funny, I actually did this to be serious, is that I heard Jared from Subway on the radio on Monday morning. He ran in the New York City Marathon, and the DJs were talking about how, oh, he sounds like such a nice guy, and I was like, yeah, he does sound like a nice guy. And I was like, wouldn't it be great if he was on Dancing with the Stars? So I'm thinking that, I forget about it. That night I'm talking to my sister, who has a completely different life, and I was saying to her, you know, oh, I just remembered there was somebody I would think would be great on Dancing with the Stars, and she said, you know who I think would be great? Jared from Subway. I was like, oh my God. So we started a Facebook group called, you know, Jared the Subway Spokesmodel for Dancing with the Stars, please. We're modeling it after the campaign. So I think there are things you can do on Facebook that you can't really do on Twitter and other things that I enjoy it for.
Well, that is, you know what, that is hilarious and worthwhile. I like things that are both, you know, and
right.
it solves two things at one time. It gives people a chuckle, and then just think how cool that would be if he
right.
were. I mean, who knows? Maybe
right.
he can dance.
Right. Well, he ran the marathon, so it's kind of like, I think, you know, running, being in it, and you know, I think about it, like, if I was Subway, I would try to push that, because they could sponsor it and all that kind of stuff, so.
Sure, that
you
would
know.
Be great.
So, anyways,
well,
but I...
You know what, I just maybe would suggest a campaign for you, since you, you know, have had this, you know, all these hedge fund guys, and you interviewed a lot of the successful ones for the new book. In doing all of that, did you ever consider looking for one of them to be my next husband, you know?
No, if I'm using the book to get a stepping stone, as a stepping stone to get someone a husband, that
uh-huh.
person is me.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, couldn't you look after both of us, darling? That's what I'm thinking. You know, to me it sounds like it should be fertile ground, you know?
But. No, you would think. I mean, most of the people were older. You know, I think that should be my next book, though, is to interview the young, hot guys of hedge funds that
I
would like to marry
it.
An older woman.
hedge fund hotties, you know? I mean, it would be for sure bestseller. I guarantee I would buy one.
Exactly. I hope so. Well, I'll think about it. I will. It could be a stepping stone for both of us. Let's think about it that
yeah.
way.
I'm so totally ready to co-author that book. I can't even tell you. So, Kathleen, you have just been a delight in my life for a number of years. I cannot tell you how many times I have had just a, you know, a fun laugh and a lingering laugh, because the comedy that you put out online, it stays. It the term resonates is overused a lot, but yours really does resonate, because I can remember it after I've read it and laughed.
Thank you. That's wonderful.
And you've just been a delightful guest today, so thank you so much for coming by.
Well, thank you for having me, and I would love to do it again. So thank you.
You have been listening to Women Are Not Funny Radio, a New Media International production. On behalf of Kay Ballard, her fabulous guest, and the secretly hilarious Women Are Not Funny team, thanks for being here. You can listen to our replays anytime you please, but it's so much more fun when you're here. So join us again live next Friday afternoon for Women Are Not Funny Radio.